Intervju Radija Študent.
Spoštovane poslušalke pa cenjeni poslušalci, z nami je trobentač Nate Woolley, ki bo danes večer igral skupaj s svojim kvintetom v klubu Cankarjevega doma. Še pred tem pa se bova malce pomnila o tem in onom, med drugim tudi o njegovem delu, ki ni nujno samo glasbeno oziroma samo instrumentalno. So, hello Nate, nice to have you here.
Thank you.
For the second time, by the way. The interview with Nate was already done once in June 2011, I think.
Yeah,
so we have him back and I would like to elaborate a little on DRAM, the database of recorded American music that you're working on. Can you elaborate on this project? What are its purposes and
sure.
What's your role in it?
DRAM stands for the Database of Recorded American Music, and it's a large database, just basically of streaming music, but it was originally intended to be for specifically for research. For musicians to do research on experimental music. So that's what it was set up to do, and then I came on and I've tried to expand it so that it has all kinds of, not just American music to start with, and also just not experimental music, but folk music and things like that, and also to get it to expand out so it's not just in colleges, but that anybody can listen to the music, they can subscribe and do their own research, is not just for academic purposes.
And it's only got recorded music available, or there is other material that one can draw from?
Recorded music, there's archival, again, streaming music, and then there are some printed things that you can look at as well. Liner notes, record covers, in some cases in the archives, there are programs from the original concerts that you can look at, or posters from the concerts that you can get an idea of, and we're working now to be able to do video as well, so hopefully we'll have video up soon.
You've written I think somewhere about this project being somewhat utopian in its aims. How come and in which aspect?
Well, when I wrote about that, it was talking a lot about how it's a somewhat impossible, like a utopian by definition is impossible, you know. You can't, that's why it's utopian. But a project like that, the idea was to create a certain broad understanding, especially about American music for Americans, that was a true picture of what American music is, because I don't know what it's like in here, in Slovenia, but in America we view, a lot of people view American music as like Aaron Copland, the blues, a very specific kind of jazz, and like Elvis Presley, and that's it. But America itself is such a huge country, and it's got so many different cultures in it, that it really should be like 13 different countries. And each of those cultures has its own very specific music, some of which, you know, I'd never heard living in New York until someone laid it on me. You know, there's music in the Midwest that only lives in the Midwest. And so we tried to kind of put together a project where it would be a very broad picture of what US music is, including all this stuff. So, and weighting them equally. So Aaron Copland would be as important as the Ypsilanti noise scene in Michigan, which would be as important as the free music scene in Louisville, Kentucky, you know, and just give a real picture of what's actually going on in the country.
I was wondering, is that, I mean, yeah, it's utopian, but does it even make sense to talk about American music, because this is a field so broad, so vast, and so interconnected with other continents that in a way, it's a rather artificial construct.
It's an artificial construct, absolutely. I think the reason that it still makes sense to do it is not because we think we'll come up with something definitive, but because it starts conversations exactly like that conversation. It's so interconnected with other cultures. That's something that I think a lot of Americans don't realize. But if you start to put these things out there, like we talk about the influence of musics from this part of the world on the people that live in Pennsylvania, then people in America will wake up a little to go, oh, this isn't something that just came out of America. This is something that comes from another country. And let me see what that effect is. So it's not even supposed to be kind of a construct of American music, but to show how everything is connected. And hopefully you don't, you know, the person doesn't stop at how it affects America, but how these other countries' musics affect each other and how music has grown throughout the world. But as impossible as it is to do in America, it's really impossible to do in the world. So it's just kind of setting up certain parameters, setting up a project where people can come to it and say, well, this isn't enough. Well, that's great. That means go look for more stuff. At least someone started the process and we can all kind of start to talk about how music is made and how it comes from one country to another.
Still the same, there is a certain expressing that there is the more the American strand of jazz and the European strand of jazz. And how would you elaborate the difference between one and another?
It's funny because I just wrote a lot about this, about the jazz thing, and I don't perceive a difference necessarily, because I can hear European jazz musicians that have the things that we would call American, you know, the swing and the things that technically would be American jazz. I think American jazz musicians have a real issue with the tradition because they're American. So if you grow up like me, a trumpet player in America, you have to deal with Louis Armstrong and you have to deal with Miles Davis, and you can't get out of it. These are the rules and you have to play by them to a certain extent. The thing that I think is different about European jazz is they can choose to deal with that tradition by trying to learn it, or they can say, well, that doesn't have anything to do with me, so I will find a way to express who I am. And so it comes out very different. Most of the European musicians I know are from England. Those just tend to be the people I play with. So someone like Evan Parker or Paul Litton have talked about, we realized someday that we're never going to be John Coltrane or Elvin Jones because we didn't grow up in the South of America and we're not black and we've got none of those experiences. So what does it sound like if we make the music of guys from London that grew up in a certain way? And what they came up with is like nothing that came out of the US. And I think that happens all over Europe when you hear Slovenian musicians, you hear Polish musicians, or musicians from Spain or Italy. There's still elements of the tradition, but whether they've done it consciously or not, they've said, but you know, I'm not that person. I'm not from Detroit. And so I don't have that experience, so I'm gonna play it like a guy from Barcelona. And that's a great thing. I mean, I think that's the true difference. And it's what makes it kind of beautiful over, say, classical music, where the tradition is so deep that you could put, you know, a Thai player versus a US player versus someone from Holland, and they're all gonna play it basically the same. Mm-hmm. But in jazz, all these differences come out.
And what's your take on an observation that some drummer made, that in America the ethnic and the racial dimension of jazz is much more present than, let's say, here, and that actually genres sort of have a much more objective value due to the fact that they're connected with certain cultures?
We actually just talked about this on tour. I don't perceive a huge difference in race, but a lot of people I talk to do. So I could be, it could be my experience is different. In America, jazz music is a black music, but it's strange because there have been eras where the white population has taken it over. I think at one point it was very exotic. And at one point, just like, I mean, I don't know if this happens elsewhere, but in the US, what tends to happen is the music comes out of a certain culture and then it's taken over by business. And whatever that business needs to do to make more money, that's what that music becomes. And that's happened with jazz. I mean, that's, you know, what it started out with, Louis Armstrong, and went through to Count Basie and Ellington, and the fact that Benny Goodman's band made the most money and Stan Kenton's band made the most money. That was during a time of segregation, so that meant something then. But even past that, what's, you know, why did John Coltrane and Miles Davis have a certain place in jazz, but when did that become about Keith Jarrett and other, you know, when did that kind of become what the record label wants the face of that to be? And I think there's a lot of questions around that and around race, because it's presented in such a way that race, even if it's not consciously brought up, the way it's marketed, it's always kind of there. And I think it's there in a way that in some instances it becomes about the African-American culture, and I think that can be a very strong thing, because it's a unifying aspect, and it's filled with pride for that culture. And I think it can also be represented, especially by record labels and media, as still trying to be that exotic thing which separates that community from the people buying it. And that can be a really negative thing. So it's a really complicated issue. And it's one, I would say my own personal thing, that the thing that I think is really sad about it is that we're 100 years into jazz and people are still afraid to have conversations about that. Mm-hmm. We don't have conversations, we don't say anything, and then all of a sudden something explodes and then we all kind of nervously look away and then don't say anything again. Instead of just saying it's a black music that was taken over by white people at some point, we don't know why, we don't know what's valid, we don't know what's not valid, but we're not talking about mm-hmm. it.
Could you say there is a sort of, let's maybe intellectualism in the musical scene, because there is a popular trope of saying let the music speak for itself and similar, and can you elaborate on this observation?
Yeah, I think that's part of the tension that sometimes happens, especially in the past 20 years in American jazz, is that, like, some people feel like there has to be an anti-intellectualism. I don't want to talk about it. It is what it is. And some people really want to talk about it. And especially in the past 20 years, the universities teach jazz in this very intellectual way. So a lot of people come out with that kind of thinking. I don't think either one is bad. I think the only problem arises when someone that believes one thing doesn't respect someone that believes another. Mm-hmm. And that's where we get, I don't know if that happens elsewhere, but in the US, we get this kind of thing of, well, that's not jazz. This is jazz and that's not jazz. Because this person talked about it in this very intellectual way, automatically that's not jazz. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily believe in that. I think that typically when people bring that up, they have just said that jazz is all inclusive, as long as you don't do this and you don't do this and you don't do this and you don't do this. So for me, I don't necessarily know that it's an anti-intellectual music. I mean, if you study jazz, it's a heavily intellectual music, because it's harmony, the way people deal with harmony and all this. A lot of that is brain power. And even to play it by ear takes a lot of brain power. Mm. So it's just a choice of whether you want to talk about it or not and what language you want to use. Mm. You know?
Well, you actually managed to persuade a lot of people to talk about jazz in your online magazine,
Sound American.
Yeah. And you asked the musicians, different ones, from Tim Byrne to our Slovenian pianist Kai Draxler, and you asked them what jazz has to include and what jazz has to exclude to still remain jazz. And may I ask you the same question? What does jazz has to include to remain itself?
It's a good question. I mean, the common answer we got is improvisation. I don't necessarily believe that it has to have improvisation. I think that the thing jazz has to include is a consensus that it's jazz. And the idea, and I'm stealing that a little bit from one of the guys that answered it, but I thought it was the answer closest to what I thought as well. When people are in a room and you're playing music, you get a feeling that, yes, what we're doing is jazz. And sometimes you're doing the things that technically people would call jazz. So it's got improvisation, right? It's got a feeling of swing. It's connected to a jazz tradition. These are like the technical things that people bring up that means it has to have jazz. But you can have 50 people in a room, and if they don't believe it's jazz, then it's not jazz. So it's a strange word. And it means something differently to everybody. And everybody has a different version of what has to be in it for it to be jazz. And so then what happens is when you put those people in a room, whether it's just you or I talking to each other, or whether it's 1,000 people in a hall, it becomes this weird democratic consensus that was jazz, that wasn't jazz. Mm-hmm. So I think that consensus has to be there. I think the word jazz is not musical anymore. I think it's social. Mm-hmm. Because so much of what the consensus is jazz has nothing to do with what jazz is today. Mm-hmm. And so many jazz musicians don't call themselves jazz musicians anymore. They just, this is the music I play, and they skirt the issue because it's a social issue and they don't want to be involved in it. So I think what has to be included is the consensus of the people in the room that what is being done is jazz.
Okay, well, we'll narrow things down a little bit, yeah, and go to your album, mm-hmm, Sit in the Throne of Friendship, right?
Yeah.
Supposedly the name of the album and possibly the concept is derived from the book by Jacques Derrida, The Politics of Friendship.
Yeah.
Can you explain the link between the music and the...
I was reading that book when I wrote the music, and I'd read it a couple times, and I've gotten certain things out of it that were very specific social theory, which is what that book is about. But the thing that struck me when I was writing the music is it's like a half page in the middle of the book that sticks out because it doesn't really have anything to do with anything else in the book. But he talks about there's a kind of pure friendship is what he calls it. And then how he defines it is, this is the person that when they pass away, if they pass away before you, or if there's a split that is irreparable, that can't come back, that you feel a profound loss, that you feel that there's a hole in your life. And that this was the pure form of friendship, that everything else, you know, there are all these other friendships that are based, that we all have, you know. Mm-hmm. But this is the one that is like friendship with nothing else in it, pure. And so I started thinking about that, and also how that kind of friendship devolves into different kinds of friendships. So I started looking at friendships I'd had where they got to a certain place. I've had lots of friendships like this. They get to a certain place, and then they stop, and you know you're never going to be any closer with that person, nor are you going to be any further away. It's always going to live where it is here. So then that became a piece called Sweet and Sad Consistency, because it is kind of bittersweet that I'm, you know, this is kind of the end of our growth as a friendship. And the way we end friendships, started thinking about that. And then there are a couple pieces where I had them named specifically by people that to me had are the pure have that kind of pure friendship in my life, where I thought, okay, if this person was gone, this is the person that I would where I would actually feel the loss. And so it kind of came out of that. I mean, it doesn't contain any of the social theory that Derrida's talking about, but it just, that little paragraph got me thinking for weeks about what friendship is and how we think about it. And then out of that kind of came the pieces for the record.
But otherwise, in a way, especially the jazz scene is operating under some politics of friendship in that actually you may be a good player or maybe a fantastic player, but and in the end it comes down to your charisma, because you probably won't be playing with someone your personality doesn't agree with. So at the end the musical networks are recreated through not on just on musical terms, but on terms of sort of social power one has.
That's very true, and in a lot of ways that connects to the talking about what jazz is, because I think in that issue where we asked a bunch of people things, the thing that was interesting to me that I only kind of alluded to in the beginning of my writing about it was the way people handled the politics, and not just the politics of the word jazz, but that politics of their friendship and charisma and connections to the other players. When you take a word that is so loaded like jazz and you try and define it and it's going out there and you know that people are going to read it, you have to be very careful about how you do that. And so if you read between the lines, you see a lot of people navigating those exact politics that you're talking about. Because they have to maintain a charisma, whether they're doing it unconsciously or very consciously. I think just like any other music, but especially in jazz, it's all about building social structures. My band is built in a certain way that we all get along in this very specific way, and it works somehow. And musically it works somehow. But I don't sub people out, because then it messes up the social structure more than anything else. And you look at that on a broader scale and it's obviously even more complex.
On the other hand, you got the sort of social grouping that is done by the media. And it's really interesting how you are enlisted amongst the new generation of trumpet players, along with, let's say, with Taylor Hobaum, Peter Evans, Greg Kelly, and some others. And do you agree with this sort of a generational gap or generational specific that is written about in the media?
I don't mind being grouped with those guys, mostly because I really like their music. And I mean, I feel a little proud to be put in the same sentence as Greg Kelly, you know, because he's a hero. I don't think it necessarily does anybody any favors. There have been times, although it's a little better now, but there have been times where it's always been talked about as like a trumpet revolution, and that to me implies implies that Peter and Greg and Taylor and I got together and decided we're gonna do this. But we were all doing what we did before we met each other. It just so happened that for whatever reason, the time was right for that generation to be doing that stuff. You know, maybe we all heard the right records at the right time or had the right teachers at the right time. The other problem I have with it, besides calling it a revolution in that case, is that in the generational thing, it's kind of a lie. I mean, we've been, for whatever reason, probably because Peter is so crazy technical and no one's ever really heard the trumpet technically played that way before. But that group that I'm included in has gotten a lot of media attention, you know, relatively speaking. But before us, there were people like Herb Robertson and Toshinori Kondo and tons of people in generations before that were doing all this stuff, Alan Shorter in the 60s. And just for whatever reason, the time wasn't right, or there was only one or two of them. And so I think it's a little bit sad that that only one generation has been paid attention to, and very few people talk about, well, you know, where does that come from? Where does Paul Smoker fit into this? Where does Herb Robertson fit in? When, you know, Alan Shorter, back to like Charlie Shavers in the 40s, and people expanding the instrument. It's just part of a lineage. I mean, we're just basically expanding on what was brought before. It's just we have different influences to bring in. And 20 years from now, you know, it won't matter. There'll be another group of people. You know, it's all kind of fleeting. So it's, I find it interesting is all, but not too productive.
But still, one could say that the trumpet was utilized in less adventurous ways.
Yeah.
There were specific particular people that did it, but otherwise one could say that maybe it was underutilized in the past decades. How come?
Well, it's really hard. It's really hard to play the trumpet, and it's very painful. It can be very painful. And I think in some ways the psyche of the trumpet player in general is such that the energy goes into mastering it and making it sound perfect. There aren't many trumpet players that are willing to make it sound bad, as opposed to other instruments where they don't have the same tradition and could be a little more experimental. So that's why I think like the saxophone got to this level way before we did. You know, the piano was able to break free a little bit more. And so I think now just there just happens to be a generation, and maybe this is where the generational thing comes from, where we grew up and the technical thing was kind of the basics. We knew that. We grew up playing it and being able to technically play the trumpet well and understanding what their tradition was, to the point where to distinguish ourselves, we were brave enough to say, well, what if we let this sound bad? You know, in that kind of, in what people think of as bad trumpet, splitting the sound in half, shrieking, you know, screaming through the horn, things like that, is very much against the Western idea of what the trumpet's supposed to sound like. And I think maybe in this generation, the difference is there was more than one guy that was willing to do that. There were 8 or 10 all of a sudden. Like if you start to look at Mazen Kerbaj and Liz Albee and, you know, tons of other players that all of a sudden were doing this at the same time and just saying, well, I'm bored with the Wynton Marsalis sound, you know, pure sound of the horn.
And so could you say maybe that your, in a way, your musical credo is letting things out of control in a way, because you, one of your distinctive playing things is that you use amplifiers and guitar amplifiers, delays and stuff like that, and that is in a way the sound sort of slips from your fingers after you put it out.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think one of the things I've always thought when I'm improvising is it's cool to set something up and then just pay attention to what the sound is and then try and sculpt that sound. And sometimes that sound gets away from you and then you have to kind of refocus and sculpt that sound. And that to me is what improvising is. I don't necessarily define improvising as something that has a level of control in it. I think it's beautiful to hear a bebop player, you know, perfectly play a set of changes, but I don't necessarily think that that's something I would want to do. I like the things that, the things when I was growing up that I was most attracted to are the solos or the music where it felt like the person had just gone beyond their physical boundaries and everything exploded and it was this very raw, ugly, very personal thing that they chose to let you see. I have no interest in letting people only see the good things. I think that's boring and false. So with the amplifier thing, if it squawks and screams and or if I miss a note or if the sound is very raw and I'm completely outside the harmony, that to me is more personal And I feel like I'm giving the audience something more personal than to walk away going, I hit every note perfectly with the perfect sound. And I had control over every little thing. And that's my own personal, other people feel a different way, but to me, if I haven't gone beyond what I am physically and kind of emotionally capable of, then I don't feel like I really did anything.
Well, I think we'll conclude with these thoughts. So, right. To je bil Nate Woolley, ki jo boste lahko na svoji slišali v klubu Cankrevega doma. Dotlej pa lep pozdrav.
Intervju Radija Študent.